Today in Studio 360, move over Martha Stewart. We found a guy who takes DIY to an entirely new level of extreme.
The cast-offs of industry and consumers are so rich that it's the best time to be making stuff.
He's part inventor, part artist, part repairman, and he goes by the name Mr. Jalopy.
We're all makers, we're all artists, we're all hackers, we're all in this together.
And he just might have a good way to get through these tough times.
For chewing gum money, we're able to tool up.
Later, turns out Devo was a political band. Who knew?
Nobody was really talking about the issues in the arts. We thought, well, this is a time for us to do something, to say something, and that's how we began.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, we'll talk to a listener who ditched the real estate business in Ohio and joined the theater business in Las Vegas. And remember the pioneering new wave band Devo? Well, they're back. But first, for as long as I've been alive, the name of the game in consumer products has been all about obsolescence and disposability. Now the Great Recession is making us penny pinch and maybe also knocking some deeper sense into us about what we buy and own. So out here in LA, I made a trek to visit a guy who's been way ahead of that curve to an industrial patch underneath the freeway surrounded by rusting cars.
This is my 1961 Mercedes.
Very cool.
That is Mr. Jalopy. I spent the afternoon at his workshop and garage.
I pulled this car out of a yard in Pasadena. It was headed for the crusher and it hadn't run in 20 years. And I got it running and it still needs some work.
I could call him a mechanic or a handyman or an activist or artist or philosopher, but none of those would quite cover it.
So everything is mechanical, all these little relays and motors, and it's like kind of chasing a ghost through the machine.
He's a one-man rescue squad for old cars, bicycles, jukeboxes.
Be wary of free jukeboxes, because it often turns out they're on the second story.
You probably won't find Mr. Jalopy hanging around Home Depot. He gets almost all his parts and materials at garage sales across Southern California, starting every Saturday at 6 a.m.
Every morning before I go, I'm so excited about it because you just never know. You may find the best thing that you've ever found. This could be the weekend. There's as good a chance as any other weekend. I still find it exhilarating. A lot of the stuff I buy is purely practical. I buy half-used boxes of soap, you know, and I buy 3 steel wool pads in the bottom of an old bag. And, you know, it's a wonderful way to get out into the community and pet dogs and drink kids' lemonade and peek in people's garages and meet your neighbors in this kind of incredibly personal way of them selling their underwear and you there ostensibly to buy it. And, you know, from doing this over a period of time, you get something that's broken, or you think that this would be really great if it just did this, or it needs a little gussying up. And then just from the stupidity and the bravado to just embrace, you know, my amateurism, that I'd be willing to screw it up, which I do more often than I do fix things, then I just started working on stuff.
One imagines that depending on how long and how bad and how transformative this economic moment is, that could be good for the maker movement, yeah?
I think so. I think that it gets to the point where, you know, we need to be thinking more about repairing this stuff. Which is hard, because if you buy a TV from Target that's made by a company that you've never heard of, and the power switch goes out, which should be a very minor issue, and it's 2 years down the line, you can't go to Target and get a power switch. And if you take it to a repair shop, which are few and far between, they probably can't get a power switch either. And, you know, I think what was beautiful about Make Magazine coming in is it gave this kind of overarching umbrella of we're all makers, we're all artists, we're all hackers, we're all in this together. Then it was this great opportunity for everybody to get together and learn and really cross-pollinate skills and ideas.
Which is, one imagines, the way life used to be for more people, for most people.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, up through the 60s, every house had a workbench in it. And it was an economic necessity. You had to have it the same way to provide for your family as having a refrigerator or a washing machine, because when the cord frayed on the fan, you didn't throw it away and go and buy a new one, you replaced the fan cord. So no matter how modest they are, and I've learned this from going to garage sales for 20 years, that when you go to a house of a certain age, there's always a workbench there. It may have a scattering of unprofessional tools, but also on every block there was the guy with the lathe in his garage, and there was the guy that was the ham radio operator, and the guy that repaired radios, and the amateur astronomer. And, you know, through the 70s and 80s and 90s, you know, everything became very hands-off, and that type of creative output was more in software and, you know, in computers and that sort of stuff, which is fantastic. You know, we can print magazines ourselves on our computer, we can make news websites, we can make radio stations. It's wonderful how we have this media toolbox, but we forgot the physical toolbox.
And what's interesting about this place is that, you know, hearing about you and knowing about you, one could imagine that it would be just wall-to-wall kind of nostalgia knickknacks. And it's not. I mean, there's some cool old stuff, a 7-Up clock or a Tide detergent advertising, but the balance between kind of nostalgia and practical stuff you're actually messing around with seems healthy.
Yeah, well, thanks. I think I'm within the bounds of reason still. And, you know, I'm not into retro for retro's sake. You know, I'm not into, you know, poodle skirts and malt shop. You know, I'm looking for better, not retro, better.
But with a basis, with at least a golden age of some kind where people could fix things easily.
I'm nostalgic for that engagement and that ability and that repairability and that durability. That's a sweet spot. That's where I'm running towards. I'm not trying to run backwards.
So, for instance, this machine, which looks very cool and old-fashioned with these unbelievably giant meters that say volt, ohm, condenser, and engine RPM, and it looks, I guess, like something from the 50s?
Yeah, probably from the 50s. It's an old engine testing machine that
car engine
testing machine, and you can measure things like combustion efficiency to see what your air fuel ratio is out the tailpipe if you're getting an efficient combustion rate. And the machine still works. I mean, I still use it from time to time, but, you know, this was a machine that was a cornerstone, huge investment for anybody that was like a tune-up shop. You know, it's
a Clayton dynamometer.
Yeah, and so that's the other this shop used to be a hot rod shop starting in the 60s. So it's got a dynamometer in the ground, which are these rollers that you can actually put an automobile onto and then run at full speed inside the shop and adjust the carburetor under the hood as if you're driving down the road.
So when you found this place, you must have said, I'm home.
It's pretty great, yeah. This is a horizontal bandsaw for chopping big pieces of metal. You can see the 90-inch band blade goes around here very slow. And, you know, this has got the tag on it somewhere that says Lockheed. You know, this is out of the old Lockheed plant.
Really? So this may have been used to make planes in World War II.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the great thing, you know, about living in L.A. is, you know, it was a very fertile ground for hot rodding and for innovation for the movie industry of a lot of people that were machinists and inventors and tinkerers.
There is a sort of Los Angeles specific quality to what you're about here, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. I love the the grandeur of the West. I love the myth of the West, you know, of the grapes of wrath and the better life, of the bravery of packing everybody up into the jalopy and, you know, coming out to try and carve out a place for your family. It's a, you know, it's a beautiful story.
It begins to sort of make me think that what you do is perilously close to a vast art project. How do you think about that?
I'm sneaking up on the edges of art. That's for sure. People call lots of stuff art. You know, no question about that. It's probably a little too loose. I think that I've done some interesting work and that is aesthetically pleasing. And I'm working on stuff now that I feel is going to get me there. And there's stories that can't be told any other way.
What do you mean? What are you working on that is that are stories that can only be told in this way?
I think that there's a story of, for example, it parked at the end of the block, there was a Camaro, and I always admired it. You know, it was a 70s yellow Camaro, and I ended up buying it for $1,000 and two bottles of vitamins. It's a long Byzantine negotiation that goes into all these things, but I ended up with the Camaro, and all I wanted to do was drive it to Tommy's Hamburgers, eat hamburgers, you know, sitting there on the fender of my Camaro and listen to Van Halen. That's all I wanted to do. Now, will anybody else think that this is art? I don't know. I don't really care very much. There's clearly no market for it, but it's a story that everything else has led up to me telling.
Coming up, Mr. Jalopy unveils a masterpiece, a contraption he calls the world's largest iPod. And we'll also find out what it's like to date an art superstar.
It was the high life. It was a whole different world.
Guess who?
The great one.
Cindy Sherman. We have Cindy Sherman.
This is Cindy Sherman like you never even wanted to imagine.
Cindy Sherman's jilted boyfriend has made a documentary about her. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by PBS. Save Sunday for nature as scientists around the world fight to save frogs from mass extinction. Watch Nature on Sunday at 8, 7 Central, only on PBS.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I recently spent some time with one of the most interesting people in Los Angeles. He's a hero of the so-called makers movement, people who believe that making things yourself or fixing the things you have is lots better than mindlessly buying new mass-manufactured stuff. His name is Peter, but he goes professionally by Mr. Jalopy. Like a sort of New Age Rube Goldberg, he can build elegant contraptions out of the junk he finds at garage sales. But he still likes new technology.
The iPhone is an incredibly graceful piece of technology. It's just an extraordinarily elegant, intuitive, undisappointing machine. Except for the fact that it doesn't work very well as a phone.
And the battery doesn't last very long.
It should have a replaceable battery. It should have four screws on the back of it, because if you can't open it, you don't own it. You know, I'm not a Luddite, you know, by any means. I love technology, and a lot of my machines have computers inside that do things that I'd never be able to build myself. But you know, there is a beautiful clarity to old machines too, of you know, being able to visually see what's going on and to be able to get in there and get your hands dirty.
As opposed to microprocessors.
Right, which are a little, you know, that's a little, I'm just not smart enough to do that. So I decided to build the world's largest iPod, which is this big, beautiful Farnsworth 40s radio cabinet, and then put in a hodgepodge of technology from all different eras, like the turntables from the 70s, and then it digitizes directly to an iPod, which is from, you know, 2000s. It has a computer inside, has a Sansui receiver from the 70s, and it's just kind of whatever I had available. It's cheap as I could do it. And, you know, and it's not just technological pieces, you know, the lid is held up with a knob from a 50s nut dish, and the panel, you can access the computer by these knobs that are off an old kitchen cabinet, and the computer's there to put in CDs. But you know, the cool thing about it is you're just jamming a bunch of stuff in a box, make a pretty box, unless the original buttons, you know, operate the machine still. So the original buttons that you used to select radio stations.
So these big, heavy-duty plastic buttons now actually operate the iPod. That's
yeah, there. Check it. Try pressing. That changes the volume. This will go to the next song. What happened is I wanted to listen to Dinah Washington's Drinking Again. And I knew I had it on an LP, and I didn't want to go and buy it on a new format every time a new format comes out. I wanted to hear that old version with the pops and crackles that I remembered hearing before.
That's why I'm drinking again and thinking of when you loved.
So it still has that same kind of clunky feel to it. Of an old machine,
yeah.
Even though it's doing something new.
And wishing that you were here. I'm making the rounds and buying the rounds for strangers. Yes, I'm being a fool.
You can see a video of that customized super duper iPod and the rest of Mr. Jalopy's workshop at studio360.org. And is there something you'd like Mr. Jalopy to tinker with and improve? If so, tell us about it and we'll pass along your suggestions to Mr. Jalopy.
Maybe tell some joker a joke.
If you remember the band Devo, what you probably remember is them on MTV when MTV was brand new, wearing what looked like flower pots on their heads, acting like nerds from the 22nd century, and singing this song. Although the last Devo album came out years ago, they are working on a new one and they still tour widely. And have a surprising backstory, it turns out. They came together in the late 60s when they were in college at Kent State University.
Hi, my name's Mark Mothersbaugh. I remember walking across campus one day and somebody had handed me a flyer that said that at noon, SDS was going to napalm a dog. They had this table and they had a dog that looked scared out of its mind standing there. And they said, how many of you are gonna let us go ahead and do this demonstration? And people were saying, none of us. And they said, well, why don't you stop them? Our country from napalming people in Vietnam. And I was just the right age, you know, I was like a sophomore in college. And I said, I'm signing up.
I'm Jerry Casale from Devo. We were protesting the expansion of the war into Cambodia from Vietnam without an act of Congress. So people were outraged.
Don't
I mean, we'd seen military vehicles all around the campus, but that they would actually turn and shoot protesters, it seemed, I just couldn't imagine how it got that out of control.
We start our protest. These guys come out of several buildings, gas masks, M1 rifles. They've got about 2,000 students surrounded. And the next thing we know, guys on the top of the hill by the journalism building stop. The first row kneels, the second row stands, and they point all those M1 rifles at us, and they shoot. And to be right there and see the effects of that kind of bullet in a human being. I thought I was going to puke. Then I thought I was going to pass out. And I just sat down on the grass, and I couldn't move. And pretty soon you start hearing wailing and crying, and everybody had been reduced to little children.
What happened immediately is that they closed down our school. Jerry and I started talking about music, and things came into focus for us on what we wanted to do. We saw that right about that time when people we thought should have gotten enraged and be proactive, it seemed like everybody went to sleep. When school started up again in the fall, it seemed like everything was different.
The way a hippie reacted to the killings at Kent State is like, wow, not cool, man. And the killings just snapped me. I had to create, like reinvent who I thought I was. I wanted a complete break with any kind of just groovy, student, hippie kind of appearance or lifestyle.
You know, we thought that the things that we'd seen would have justified a whole new generation of Bob Dylans and, you know, Woody Guthrie's, and it wasn't happening. Instead, we were getting disco and concert rock, you know, the Foreigner and Styx, and nobody was really talking about the issues in the arts. We thought, well, this is a time for us to do something, to say something, and that's how we began.
De-evolution was just the word we slapped on the phenomena that we saw around us. We didn't see the world getting better. We didn't see progress being made. We didn't see people getting smarter. We saw quite the opposite. They tell us that we lost our tails. Evolving up from little sails. I say it's all just wind and sails. Are we not bad? We are Devo. Are we not bad? Devo. We were doing it to reach something pure, to get rid of all the assumptions, all the stupid cliches and artifacts of imitating, you know, stadium rock bands or pop bands. Just the opposite. We were going for a purity, industrial brutality. Our feelings aesthetically were a result of the anger and frustration, you know, and shock of the life we were living after Kent State.
Akron, which was a big industrial town from like 1900 through 1960, all of a sudden the factories moved out pretty much all at once. So it was like a really dark time.
You know, what we were doing was keeping ourselves sane, really, and doing something aggressive. I mean, the more the kind of idiot people that were our peers didn't like what we were doing, the more heartened we became and the more confident we became we were doing something right.
Yeah, we absorbed it and went right back at them.
It was like, look, either you're one of those people that let all this happen and even halfway agree with it, or you're with us.
Jerry Casale and Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo. They've got a new album due out this fall. Michael May produced our story. Same time that Devo was sending their odd ripple through pop music, Cindy Sherman was launching her career in visual art, and she became one of the defining and enduring artists of her era.
Probably of all the people that you're to ask who is blah blah in the art world, Cindy Sherman is probably the one who you will get the least clear answer, because people know her from so many identities.
Sherman makes photographs and appears in almost every one. A lot of them look like stills from movies you can't quite place, or portraits from a commercial photo studio in a slightly bizarre alternate universe. A new documentary about her has just come out.
What's not to like? This cute, sexy girl who's in a very self-reflexive way uncovering our, you know, notions of beauty and our stereotypes and Hollywood mythologies, and it was easy work to like, but it was difficult work.
It is a documentary with a twist, though. It's made by the artist's ex-boyfriend, a guy named Paul Hasegawa Overacker, also known as Paul H.O. When he met Cindy Sherman, he was the host of a New York City public access cable show called Gallery Beat, which was kind of a real-life Wayne's World about the art scene.
Well, I think she's feeling a lot of pain.
There's a lot of passion in that work. A lot of passion. A
lot of anger.
Anger. Doesn't seem like it, though, when you talk to her. She seems pretty normal. I think it's just like art is a way to work stuff out, right? Or a cry for help. And I'll be willing to help.
So interesting.
I'm helping. I want to help her.
Paul, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much, Kurt. It's great to be here.
What did you have a single favorite moment while you were doing Gallery Beat?
Well, I would say it would have to be the interviews with Cindy. I think that that was definitely the high point of Gallery Beat. You know, I was just totally disarmed because, for one thing, I really think that she is the type of woman that I get along with pretty well, for one thing. And I think she felt the same way.
No one's ever done this before, have they?
Never, never.
So you're like a virgin.
Yes.
She's like this virgin to the video camera. Well, I heard that you've done it before.
No, no.
What drew you to her as you did the first interview and then the second and then the third? What entranced you?
Well, I'd been an admirer of her work for a long time. I mean, I saw her work back in the early 80s, and I saw, you know, I saw this cute woman, for one thing, and I like women. And I thought she was really cute and very intriguing, and I thought, who is this girl?
You just really cover yourself. As we know, you cover yourself up completely, so we don't actually know what you look, but look at it.
Yeah.
Pretty cute. She doesn't want everybody to know how cute she is, that's why. So, and here's the various shades of makeup, and but whenever I see her, she's really not wearing very much at all.
Well, that's how much you know.
Yeah.
And as one watches the clips from those interviews in this documentary, it is clear, and you make clear in the movie, that you're kind of courting her on television.
You know, that was a little bit like my style anyway, of being able to work with artists. And I think that, I mean, you're an interviewer and you know that you don't deal with everyone the same way.
When it evolved into a romantic relationship, what do you think drew her to you?
Beats me. I don't know. I get along with girls. I'm straight. I don't know. I mean, Gallery Beat was a really kind of very much on the inside of the art world, the actual experience, you know? I mean, really, it would be the same as if I was in this with a tribe of Aborigines who had befriended me.
Hey, there's Julian Schnabel. Hi.
August 9th.
Remember me? I'm Paul from Gallery Beat.
Do I remember you? I saw your idiotic program on TV.
Thank you.
I mean, I thought what you had to say was so glib and stupid that maybe I should have been more rude to you before.
Really? Yeah, well.
You didn't like it?
No, that's
is it supposed
what we
to be a
do.
Service, or is it supposed to be
No, it's
something?
Not supposed to be a service.
You might want to, like,
it's not an educational
somebody.
Tool.
It's just sort of a masturbatory, like, exercise in stupidity.
Oh, come on. This is not PBS. People don't have to look at art like it's such a serious deal.
You angered people with this show.
There was a lot of different reactions, but I'd have to say that what we did was we showed the art world for its sense of fun, and it really was appreciated by artists, and artists were our big supporters. And if you don't get the artists, you're not going to get anywhere, because they're really the ones who make the decisions about what is the taste of the day.
You're doing this kind of Wayne's World thing, Wayne's World meets the art world, which is Gallery Beat. You're attracted to this woman, she's attracted to you. Did your life suddenly change? Did you go from being this sort of, you know, bohemian goofball to being a guy in the fast lane? That's what it looks like in the film.
Well, yeah, I had definitely a learning curve of a certain sort, because, I mean, her world was quite a bit different than mine. I mean, she was going out with Steve Martin, and, you know, she was pretty comfortable with Hollywood set, top-level type of personality people. And yeah, I hadn't actually ever, you know, lived that way. I mean, all of a sudden, I might be having dinner with Dennis Hopper and, you know, David Geffen or something like that. And there's no doubt I hadn't done that before. So I had to, you know, bone up a little bit. But I don't think that I could really change myself that much. I mean, why would I do that? You know, I tried to maintain who I was and what I was doing during that initial period, because I still was doing Gallery Beat. And so, you know, I mean, I had a lot of material for the first couple of years, but then the camera kind of had to be put away after that.
The movie's title, Guest of Cindy Sherman, refers to your identity as the non-famous half of this couple. Did you obsess over that, or was it a sudden sort of, did it suddenly become untenable in the end?
Oh, well, I think it just hit me at a certain point in my life. You know, it was kind of, I say in the film, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. I don't know why. I just couldn't take it. I'd sat down. I mean, I was looking for my seat at this rather small and very posh dinner party, and I couldn't find my seat. And someone came up to me and said, "I know where you're sitting." And they sat me down, and my place card said, "Guest of Cindy Sherman." And I don't know. It just started to dawn on me that's where I was after all of those years, and I knew these people, and I was, you know, people were introducing themselves around the table, and I said, "Oh, yes, well, I'm guest."
I think this is a male ego issue that you need to confront head on.
The fact of the matter was is that I was mad because I didn't have a name. I didn't have a name, and that was all I had. I just had a name, and it was gone. That became the basis for the film, basically, was the Guest of Cindy Sherman moment, and how my life had led up to that.
How long after that moment and after that blow up, how much longer did the relationship last?
Oh, a couple of years. A couple
oh,
of
really?
Years. Yeah.
Do you still speak to Cindy Sherman?
We haven't spoken in quite a while. You know, she has a different feeling about the film, and she's come out publicly against it, and no, our communications haven't been warm and fuzzy.
Were there particular scenes that she said, no, you can't show that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'd say one of the key scenes that Tom and I were so kind of heartbroken over losing was Cindy and I were dancing to some great rock and roll. I think it was the Wrens. in front of the Christmas tree and one of these big Christmas type of things that she liked to have, and we're dancing, and we have the parrot, Frida, and I'm goofing around with Frida, and we're all jumping around and really making fools of ourselves. And it's such a magic moment, you know, in that version of the film. And she took that out, and we were at a little bit of a loss. But overall, I'd have to say her removing a lot of material from the film really helped us make a story that moves along. So, you know, I think it all worked out.
In the case of this happy couple dancing to rock and roll in front of a Christmas tree, sounds like a great scene. Why do you suppose she wanted to delete that?
I think it was too personal. You know, that wasn't the Cindy that, you know, she wanted people to see. It was a little bit, you know, too human or something. I don't know. I can't tell you how she thinks, honestly. I mean, I don't know. I don't even know how women really think. Anyway.
Well, you've got a lifetime to figure it out. Thank you very much. That was great.
You know what? It's great. You sound just like Kurt Anderson.
I do an uncanny imitation.
You really do. You sound just like him. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Paul H. Ode's documentary is called Guest of Cindy Sherman. You can see a clip at studio360.org. Coming up, what do you do when you find that your line of work doesn't have any more work?
Nobody ever taught us about change, which is the, you know, the third inevitable thing in your life beside death and taxes.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by PBS. Save Sunday for Masterpiece Classic and Charles Dickens' sprawling saga of one family's rise from rags to riches. Masterpiece Classic presents Little Dorrit, Sunday at 9, 8 Central on PBS.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. With more than 4 million American jobs evaporated in the last year, lots of people are trying to figure out how to start over. They might try taking a cue from an industry that got whacked almost a decade ago, not by the economy, but by technology, by Napster. When people started downloading music for free, a generation of record label employees had to start finding ways to reinvent themselves. Studio 360's Eric Molinsky talked to some of them to see how that worked out.
Tom Werman was the kingmaker of hair bands. Motley Crue, Twisted Sister, Poison.
I took what was pop about those bands, and I tried to feature that and hide their weaknesses.
Working at CBS Records, Tom felt like a corporate rock star.
I remember standing in line to check in. Maybe there are three or four guys in line. They've all got Hart, Schaffner & Mark suits and briefcases, and they're looking at me in my jean jacket and long hair and motorcycle boots and saying, what is this guy doing here? And you're saying, you should come out with me tonight, you sap. I was one of you. Now I'm liberated.
But as far as music fans were concerned, Tom was just another corporate suit. He was part of an industry that exploited artists and overcharged for albums. When the internet came along, people could download music for free, and they were sticking it to the man. The industry was really slow to adapt to this new technology. When profits dwindled, they downsized. Tom struggled to stay in music. A lot of people got laid off, like Kate Hyman, who worked at V2 Records.
I'd sold more records for that label than anybody else put together. But when they cut the budget, I was one of the people to go.
The first people to get fired were the mid-level execs who discovered and developed artists. Kate was famous for turning the underground DJ Moby into a global star.
when I first started, it was all about artist development. There is no such thing anymore. And anybody that tries to sign someone and mentions that word, you can walk out right away because they're lying.
Lisbeth Cassidy also saw the writing on the wall. She was a pop music publicist, but she was afraid to leave the industry. She didn't think she had other skills. Then she had an epiphany when she visited her mother in the hospital.
The women and men that were taking care of her at this hospital were fantastic, and she was getting ready to go, and you could tell, and the nurses knew, and one came in and they said, you know, Mrs. Cassidy, it's been an honor and a privilege to work with you, and I hope our paths cross again, you know, full well knowing that she was not going to make it through the night. So I walked out of that room and I thought, you know, when I'm done with the music business, I'm going to go become a nurse.
Her family thought she was nuts, and so did Lisbeth.
I mean, I could write a press release, I could pitch an artist, and I can get you booked on a TV show, but, you know, how to palpate your spleen, I don't know if I could do that.
But she did go to nursing school, and it turned out to be a pretty good fit.
You know, when people are ill, it's such a difficult time for them, and they might be anxiety-ridden or have depression or in pain or any number of emotions and feelings. And if you can just make their day just a tiny bit better, it's so rewarding.
You know, it's funny. I was just thinking, like, ironically enough, these skills you probably learned as a publicist. You know, you ever deal with a patient or with a family member and they say thank you and you say, please, compared to Mariah Carey?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That was a big question for all the former music execs. Do their skills translate? Kate Hyman has managed to stay in music by starting her own record label. It's called Little Monster. They make children's music.
We're not afraid to give a song away digitally, which a lot of majors are still, which is insane.
But Kate's also looking beyond music. The Obama campaign inspired her to bring her managerial skills to the public sector.
I joined the town board. I'm a politician now in my town, and I'm actually running for the county legislator. I hate to say it. I mean, I haven't completely grown up, but I've become a little more mature than that rock and roll vision.
So what happened to Tom Werman, the kingmaker of hair bands? He moved his family to upstate New York to start a bed and breakfast. His turning point came when a friend gave him a picture book for adults called Who Moved My Cheese? Two lab mice discover that the cheese is no longer in the maze. One mouse takes off to find more cheese. The other mouse won't budge until he finds out who's responsible.
And I was that dumb mouse. The whole book was about unanticipated change and how to deal with it. Nobody ever taught us about change, which is the, you know, the third inevitable thing in your life beside death and taxes. After I finished, I simply put the palm to my forehead like I could have had a V8, and I said, we're out of here. We both lie silent, still
in the dead of the night. Right now, with the economic crisis that we're going through, a lot of industries are starting to look like the music industry. The way that people had been getting work, even if they were out of work and where they would expect to find work, it's all changed. And a lot of people feel like that angry mouse who refuses to budge till he finds out who moved his cheese. But it just might be time to leave the maze. But I guess that's why they say every rose has its thorn. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky. Just like every night has its dawn. Just like every cowboy sings a sad song. Every rose has its thorn.
I wonder if they have that on Guitar Hero. Trying to make the best of a bad situation can require some creative thinking and radical leaps. A couple of weeks ago, we asked if any of you have had to make that kind of leap, and if so, how you did it. Is that Lakeisha?
Yes.
Hi, it's Kurt Anderson.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
Good. So you were in real estate for 11 years, and we should look to you from now on, I guess, to know when things are going to go south, because you decided to get out of real estate a couple of years ago.
I did. I sold primarily historic properties in an urban setting, and I think I just felt it a little bit quicker than the rest.
And you decided to make the not just left turn, but I don't know, 120-degree, 150-degree turn into theater and stage management. How did you come upon that?
Well, I volunteered for a modern dance company in Dayton and volunteered for several of their events and fundraisers and realized that I have an interest in this, and why not see if there's a career in this?
What do you love about it?
I love having a room full of strangers end up feeling a sense of community. There's a kinesthetic experience that I enjoy.
And so to pursue that, you decided you needed to go back to school and get a degree in event management, and you needed to get out of Dayton.
I did. That is because I decided to follow my partner. So he got a job here in Vegas, and I followed him here to finish a degree.
And I guess Las Vegas is more of a theater stage management kind of place than Dayton, Ohio.
Absolutely it is. It's been a good move.
Has that switch entailed big lifestyle changes?
Well, absolutely. I used to have a really nice house. I drove a pretty fancy car, and I don't dress up any longer. I don't have the fancy car. I've got a used 10-year-old car now. But I think putting my energy into what I want to do and finishing this degree are more important than those material things.
Do you have a vision for, in 5 years, what kind of thing you're going to be doing?
I hope to produce festivals, culturally based festivals that promote diversity and bring a community together.
Along the lines of what they do in Edinburgh every August.
Exactly, yeah. No, tickle me to death.
Well, I wish you good luck.
Thank you so much.
Lakeisha Sable lives in Las Vegas. And we want to hear from you. If you've left one field, involuntarily or not, to devote yourself to a new passion, tell us about it at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can also subscribe to the free podcasts of Studio 360. Josh Green is something of a creative entrepreneur. He's a conceptual artist who comes up with projects that try to provide a real service to his audience. One of his pieces is called Unlicensed Therapy, and it's pretty much exactly what it sounds like. From San Francisco, Tanya Katenjian has the story.
Anyone is an unlicensed therapist, your mom, your best friend. You know, and if you think about, like, sitting in a room talking to someone, and that's all you're doing, is somewhat luxurious in a way. I grew up in Los Angeles. I'm Jewish. Those things usually mean you have some or many experiences with therapy. And my parents got divorced when I was quite young. My mom also happens to be a psychoanalyst. About 8 years ago, I wrote all these proposals that were like one-liner proposals. You know, one of them was like, open an unlicensed therapy practice.
It was early 2001. Josh set up a therapy office in San Francisco's Mission District. It had a couch, a plant, a comfortable chair, and soft lighting. He had several paying patients. But not long after he opened the practice, the California Board of Behavioral Sciences sent him a letter asking him to shut it down. Josh's mom, the psychoanalyst, wasn't so thrilled about her son's experiment either.
In the early years, she was, I think it was somewhat of a threat to her. I think she thought I was sort of making fun of what she did and taking it lightly. But I think she sort of sees it differently now.
A curator in town asked Josh to revive the project for a gallery show called Amateurs. This time, he didn't have to worry about the Board of Behavioral Sciences. He wasn't renting an office space on the street. He had the protection of a real arts organization, the Wattis Institute. Josh had not practiced unlicensed therapy for some time, and he noticed a change in himself.
I mean, what's been really fascinating to me doing this project again, 7, 8 years later, is that maybe I've grown a little bit. Maybe I'm in a different position in my life in a number of different ways.
I found Josh to be very thoughtful in his responses and his questions, and I felt pretty comfortable, you know, in general.
That's one of Josh's patients from the gallery show.
I think I'm a better unlicensed therapist today than I was in 2001. And because of that, I think the results, they're different than they were before.
So I think I talked about things that I didn't think I would, you know, things that I talk about with my, you know, licensed therapist.
sure that there were people who came in and talked to me and cried and revealed things to me, but I find that I've somehow found a way to be in the role of an unlicensed therapist, whatever that means, in a better way. And it doesn't mean being a therapist. So, you know, it's murky. A lot of it is very murky.
Contemporary art is murky. It's hard to define. One thing we do know, art offers a change in perspective. And it triggers emotions. And ideally, it transforms us in some small way. And that's how therapy functions. Now, it doesn't seem so strange that a therapy office would be in a gallery.
The notion of being listened to is and someone offering their advice, there's something where you feel like, okay, what I have to say might be interesting to the world and to the person who's asking me these questions. So, I don't know, maybe it made me feel a little bit more important.
Josh was often amazed at the openness of his patients. Some even treated him like a doctor.
I get a lot of requests for medication. But since I'm not an unlicensed psychiatrist, I'm not able to provide any prescriptions for medication.
For Studio 360, I'm Tanya Katenjian.
And that is it for this week's Studio 360. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is produced by PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Alana Harper,
Rob Weisberg,
Kurt Schlachter,
Josie Holtzman,
Nick Haling.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
What does a fancy restaurant have in common with a chemistry lab?
You like food, don't you?
These are all various gums, stabilizers, hydrocolloids.
If you're Chef Wiley Dufresne, a lot.
I mean, there's our liquid nitrogen delivery for the day.
Nitrogen. The art and science of a fantastic dish. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.